That's all I know.
Are you successfully going to Sweden?
Looks like it. Should be up now. If you go, it might work. If you go to www.downs.ca/presentation/299. Oh, it's not going to be there yet, but it will be shortly. Where does it say embed? It's embed. Here we go. Okay. Oh, this is fun. I love doing stuff like this. Okay. If you reload the page, you should see the Hangout running on that presentation page.
So do I have to do this last 299?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it won't work otherwise. Any joy?
No, but maybe I'll.
Presentation, singular. No me. Just Downs? Yeah. Yeah, Downs, www.downs.ca/presentation/299. And, yeah, there it is.
Nice.
Well, I suppose we stay with the
picture here too,
aren't
we?
Can we get
pictures?
Absolutely! Yes. Ed has already done the deed, so you know, I was just looking at the thinker a few weeks ago.
Daryl?
Oh, just God, Daryl? This guy.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
The brother.
I can't wait. You better rub his head. Oh. Good luck. Hey, Aaron.
Photo
bomb.
We'll try that again. We'll try that again.
All right.
Jeez. Max. There we go.
Yeah.
And we're just waiting for the talk to start. Everything looks good. We do appear to be broadcasting. We do appear to be video casting. Not sure if we're recording, but that's all up to YouTube now.
It's always a good sign when people just keep talking. That's a really good show. We'd like to insert a few public service announcements right here before we get on with this activity. So bear with us. There were some things that were pointed out that we need to tell the whole group.
Just a couple of little things, like where you're going to eat breakfast, that kind of stuff. I think somebody asked about in the program, they said, so where's breakfast tomorrow morning? Breakfast will be right here. All the meals will be in this room. So always show, if you show up here, you'll be safe. You know, so long as there's a meal, we promise you'll get to eat.
About the breakfast, if you're using the shuttles to one of the three other hotels, please don't eat there. You're included in the breakfast as well. So I had that question asked as well.
Or you can eat in both places. Isn't that okay too? We're only paying for this one though. The other thing is that if, with respect to parking, just be aware that if you are parked out in, I don't know if that's the front of the Kinnear Center, but out that way, that there's two-hour parking out there, and the two-hour parking limit is enforced. You will get a ticket, and it's not the Banff Center that does it. It's enforced by the City of Banff. So be aware of that. If you would like to park for free, you can park in behind the Professional Development Center, which is where many of you are staying. There's free parking back there, and I'm also told that there is free underground parking in the Music and Sound Building up behind us there. So just so you're aware of that as far as parking goes. And I think that's it for public service.
Now back to the activity. I'm sure you've learned lots of things about your neighbors, and we would encourage you to do the same at all meals, to reach out, introduce yourself, particularly for those folks either who are here on their own or are from far away, and just share with them our Alberta hospitality. So now the next part of this activity is you need to identify at the table whose birthday is closest to April 6th.
I'd say yours was
better. I think that's what she's asking, is to see this.
Can't be. Yeah.
Doesn't matter, before or after, closest to April 6th. Yeah, that's fine. So for those of you who have been identified by your table mates, we will have a birthday gift for you, and that will be available to you just before the reception starts. So come self-identify, and we'll have them set up here, and you can help yourself.
Oh, we have a person.
So.
And with that, we'd like to begin our program, and to start us off, I have the privilege of introducing somebody
really not sure
that
what
I
that
respect
is.
And admire very much. She used to be my boss. Now she's my executive director. That's Betty Gray, Dr. Betty Gray. Betty is with the department, and she is now the executive director in charge of a new sector called the Learning and Teaching Resources Sector. And did I get that right? And no.
Learning and technology.
It's, we change a lot. I don't know if that was just a career limiting move or not. if I come talk to you about a job afterwards, so you know. Anyway, I tried. Anyway, it goes without saying that I've known Betty for quite some time, so I'm sure she'll forgive me eventually. Betty and I go way back to when we were both, remember when you sort of taught about Microsoft Word and about ClarisWorks and AppleWorks, and we were busy teaching people about programs. We didn't necessarily, you know, teach them how to integrate the technology into what they were doing, so we kind of go back about that far. You can figure out how long ago that was. And since then, I've had the privilege of coming to School Technology, where until recently Betty was a director. One of the things that I can tell you about Betty is she asks hard questions, and she always makes us think, and she always questions, in a good way, what it is that we're doing. And she's a wonderful, if you ever have an opportunity to work for Betty, take that opportunity, because she'll give you lots of free rein, but she has high standards, and she expects you to do what's in the best interests for kids. And as long as you're doing that, you will always be doing it right. And Betty recently, now she may say something, maybe she won't, but Betty's become a new grandmother, and she continually reminds us that she has one more reason now yet to ensure that this education system is moving in the right direction. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce or have Betty Gray come forward to bring greetings on behalf of our minister.
Ralph, I wouldn't worry about your career-limiting move. Four pages of paper here, so please bear with me. Welcome, everyone, to Banff and to Destination Innovation 2012. Like you, I'm really looking forward to the next 3 days of exploring new ideas and learning new ways to use technology in our work with learners. I bring best wishes from the Honorable Jeff Johnson, Minister of Education, who regrets that his schedule did not allow him to attend tonight. Minister Johnson is excited about the possibilities of innovation to improve our students' learning experience. He believes that if we want to continue to give our children the best opportunity for a successful future, we must continue to push ourselves forward. In other words, continue to innovate. And he sees the power of technology to enable the vision of inspiring education, where our students are engaged thinkers, ethical citizens displaying an entrepreneurial spirit. Like other programs in our education system, our technology initiatives are focused on ensuring that Albertan students have the skills that they will need to succeed in their future. So the ability to be innovative is going to be paramount in that work. On behalf of the minister, I too would like to welcome the national and international delegates who have come from great distances, including Australia, to be with us today. And I'm also happy to welcome all the familiar faces of Alberta teachers and administrators who are here. And the minister also wants to recognize the efforts of the conference organizing committee. The collaboration between Alberta Education, To Learn Education Society, Alberta Teachers Association, and the Alberta Technology Leaders in Education is an excellent example of the power of working together. And working collaboratively also brings us that weather, so kudos to the folks for that as well. But as I'm looking around in here, I'm personally reflecting on the capacity we have in this room. We have here thought leaders who can challenge and who can push our thinking. We have school and system and department administrators who are responsible for creating the conditions to let the future emerge. We have business colleagues who can provide us with tools and resources. And we have teachers who are our frontline change agents. It's been said that nothing happens in education until it happens to a child in a classroom. With our new technologies, that classroom can be expanded into a limitless range of learning environments, where our children can explore, can ask questions, can solve real problems, can create, and can innovate. Our teachers are absolutely critical in guiding our students in those evolving learning environments. We talk a lot about the future, but to me now is such an exciting time. So moving forward, I'm pleased to announce that Alberta Education will be working with stakeholders to refresh our learning and technology policy framework. The existing framework was released in 2004, but the real work behind it was the 2 years prior to that. And so the thinking that went into that was the thinking of how we use technology and what we knew about learning about 10 years ago. So I want you for a minute to think about the technologies you brought with you or experienced at a conference about 10 years ago. And think about the technologies that you had in your home and the technologies that you had in your school or your classroom. When the policy framework was introduced, very few of us were bringing a device to a conference, let alone two or three. How many are guilty of more than one device here? And the first trenches for SuperNet were first being dug. Over the past decade, there have been significant changes to the way we approach the use of technology in our schools. Changes to what we know about how children learn. And changes in the types of policy issues we must address. We also now have Inspiring Education and an upcoming new Education Act as a context when we rework the policy framework. The updated policy will give the education system direction in the use of technology and learning and ensure that we are all purposefully aligning our efforts to enable that vision for our students in Inspiring Education. To make sure the update meets those needs, of course, we are going to be consulting with a wide range of stakeholders, including our students, our teachers, our administrators, our parents, our grandparents, who definitely want to say, our business community, our employers, and the general public. Given the enthusiasm and passion in this room for learning with technology, we're looking forward to your participation in the process, and we'll keep you posted on the types of activities and the engagement tools that we'll be using to get your feedback. So in closing, there's a lot to look forward to over the next 3 days. I encourage you to soak up as much as you can to share your experiences and your best practices. But from having attended a few conferences over the years, I know that some of the best conversations take place between the sessions and at the barbecues and things like that. So I encourage you to ask a few questions of the people when you are talking between the conferences. And the question I have in mind is this. What inspires you to be innovative? Who are you listening to on your iPod? What are you reading on your Kindle or your tablet or your Kobo? Who are you following on Twitter? Let's really tap into that innovative capacity that we have here in this room and ramp it up to shape an amazing future for our children. At this point, I'd like to invite a very innovative leader up to the podium to introduce our keynote speaker tonight. And over the past few months, he has seen a significant jump in the number of people following him on Twitter. That might have something to do with the fact that he shares the same name as our Minister of Education. Please join with me in welcoming from Alberta Technology Leaders in Education, my friend Jeff Johnson.
Hi, everybody. Ooh,
I have to turn
I'm Jeff Johnson, proudly serving Education in Alberta for 2.5 decades by choice, not elected. I'm really pleased, though, to represent the ATLE, Alberta Technology Leaders in Education. It's one of two ISTE affiliates in Alberta, and it exists for one reason, and that's to support education through the convergence of learning, leadership, and technology. So we're really happy to have been involved in helping build this what I think is going to be a great conference for all of us. And I have the real pleasure tonight, it's a genuine joy to both to spend some time this afternoon with Stephen Downs and getting to know him a little bit, but to introduce him to you as well. Stephen Downs works for the National Research Council of Canada, and he served there as a senior researcher based in Moncton, New Brunswick since 2001. Affiliated with the Learning and Collaborative Technologies Group, Institute for Information Technology, Stephen specializes in the fields of online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy. And Stephen's perhaps best known for his daily newsletter, OL Daily, which is distributed by web, email, and RSS to thousands of subscribers around the world. I had a chance to look at his website this afternoon, and I know you'll drop in on it later this evening if you haven't already. He's spoken all over the world. Prior to joining the NRC, Downs worked for the University of Alberta, a bit of a homegrown boy in a certain sense, as an information architect, and has a decade of teaching experience both in person and by distance with Athabasca University, the University of Alberta, and the Grand Prairie Regional College. Ladies and gentlemen, please make welcome Stephen Downs.
Let the moving of wires begin. Oh, you left the computer there. All right, we're still recording. We're starting over again. Yeah, I think it just started over. Okay. Hi, everyone. So he's just hooking up all of my wires and stuff. And while he's doing that, let me first say it is a pleasure to be back here in Alberta. Time about homegrown. I first moved out to Alberta in 1980 from Ottawa, where there were no jobs, to Alberta, where there are jobs. Oh, you want this?
Yes.
And so I lived in Calgary for 7 years, and then I I moved up to Edmonton, and I lived in Edmonton for 8 years, so I'm equal opportunity Albertan, and I even lived up north for a couple of years just to round it off. So, in many ways, I consider Alberta home. It's as much a home for me as any other place in the world has been, and so it's really nice to be back here and to be back home. Now, let's see if all the tech works. Click here to add title. That's a good sign. Oh, no, it is a good sign, really. All right. Okay. Let me explain what's going on here. Let's pull back. Let's go to the beginning of the presentation. That's probably a good place to start. Presentation is called The World Beyond the Word, and I'm going to have all kinds of stuff to talk about words, not so much about worlds, which is probably a good thing. But before we get going on that, let me just do some formalities. There's some of the slides are a bit text heavy. I'm sorry, but once I get going, sometimes I can't stop. But most of you, or many of you, have computer access. There's wireless in the room. If you go to that presentation page, you can see the slides. They're just posted on SlideShare. And if you have an iPad or computer at your table, just share. So everybody can have, it's like in the new airplanes, right? Everybody has their individual console, except there's only one channel. So you can show the slides to people, and that way everybody can read the words. Another thing that we're doing, which I only thought of doing this afternoon, so it's a little bit ad hoc, and you'll see that on the presentation page as well. I'm webcasting this using a Google Hangout, and the webcast has been embedded into that presentation page. Please don't click on it, because then you'll be streaming the thing that you're seeing up on the stage right now, which is not only redundant, it could result in some interesting audio experiences. We do have people in the Hangout, and now I need to remember how to get to my Hangout. Oh, I can never remember. Tab? No. Oh, that's just going to zip me through all my slides. That's no good. Okay, let's do it this way. So, here's the Hangout. There really isn't enough room for a mouse here. They've designed these podiums about 4 inches too short. And now my computer's going to do the little pie thing. Because I'm doing this live, right? I mean, if I was just doing this back at home or something, it would zip right up. But right now it's going to do the little pie thing. So I don't know what's crashing, but something's crashing. So anyhow, I'm just going to go into the presentation and hope that the Hangout is still working. If you are in the Hangout, I guess it's still working, and you can hear me. If you can't hear me, I'm sorry, but I tried, and Firefox just hung on me. I really should.
Even if it's working in the Hangout, just flip your lid back so that your camera's
pointed. Thanks. The Adobe Flash plugin has crashed. What's new? I'm sorry, Adobe people, but I call them like I see them. And you don't want to know how many times I've seen that message. So, okay, but the Hangout is still working, apparently. So there's the Hangout, and we do have a person in the Hangout. Hello. And so I'm going to try maybe later on a little audio. So A.T. Wyatt has joined us. If you're watching this on video, this is also being webcast on my YouTube channel, do feel free to jump into the Hangout, and I'll let you comment, and that might even work. I mean, I am plugged in for sound here, so if I play sound, we should get some room sound. Okay, but chat is good. All right, so let's come back then to the presentation, And I think I'm actually going to find it a little easier. Oh, right, the Adobe plugin has crashed. So I can't do that. All right. So here's the abstract. And let me say I'm really sorry about that. I read it, when preparing for this talk. I started preparing for this talk this week, and I read it, and I felt a little bit frightened by it. So I'm not going to read it all over again. A much more interesting abstract, I think, is the abstract from tomorrow's talk. Tomorrow morning, of course, we have Jeremy Hansen talking about his journey to becoming an astronaut, and that's the kind of abstract that is, something you can hang on to. I wanted to be an astronaut, but they said they'd need to add an extra booster to the rocket, so that just wasn't going to happen. But I'm looking forward to that. But let me work through my abstract step by step, and where we're going to go. We're going to take a bit of a journey through innovation, through literacy, and then back to innovation again. So let me begin where I begin with the abstract. One of the primary tasks of an educational system is to foster creativity and innovation in its students. And I have a philosophical background, so the very first thing I asked is, what does that mean? Because I don't know. So I went to the handy and always reliable source, Wikipedia. And Wikipedia defines innovation as the creation of better or more effective, and then there's a whole list of things, which I abbreviated as stuff, that are readily available to markets, governments, and society. And Wikipedia adds helpfully, innovation refers to the use of a better or novel idea or method, whereas invention refers more directly to the creation of the idea or method itself. I'm not sure how useful that distinction was, but it's there. Here's how it cashes out in the real world being the world of government funding. These are figures from the Canadian Foundation of Innovation, Canadian Foundation for Innovation, and you'll notice, you don't even need the numbers, you can see the colors heavily biased toward practical applications in things like health, and engineering, and there's a nod toward environment, and that little tiny sliver there, 2% of the funding, 6% of the grants is my field, our field actually, social sciences and humanities. So there seems to be a very, I don't want to say skewed, that's probably not the right word, but there's a certain understanding of what use and apply mean out there in the real world. I went and looked at this New York Times page on some innovations. I wonder if that link's going to work for me. No, it isn't. It's going to do that. So, the New York Times page, a new type of coffee that doesn't taste like coffee anymore. Was one of the innovations. Another one of the innovations was films that play at a greater rate of speed, more frames per second. And now I'm really scratching my head as to what innovation means. I've looked at a lot of these sites. Harvard Business Review, again, is another site that talks a lot about innovation. And it's hard to get to the heart of what innovation is, because often innovation is nothing more than finding a new market or adding some new design to an existing product. People talk about Steve Jobs as innovative as though there were no MP3 players before he came along. Now, I'm a philosopher. I'm reading all of these definitions of innovation, and it reminded me of Thomas Aquinas. And there's a lot of similarity. You see the pattern right away. Thomas Aquinas is a philosopher from the Middle Ages. He's known as St. Thomas in the Catholic Church, and he came up with an argument called, came up with five separate arguments for the existence of God. And I've listed them here. The argument from motion, everything that moves is moved by another. The argument from efficient cause, for cause to exist, there must have been a first cause. The argument from necessary being, things that exist depend on other things for their existence. Nothing pops into existence on its own. The argument from gradation, if we can conceive of good, better, best, then there must be some ideal thing which is perfect. And those of you who've studied philosophy will recognize Plato in that argument. And then the argument from design, which is still very popular, that there must be a designer in order to design the world. Now, philosophers have had about 800 years to work over these arguments. And by and large, as arguments for the existence of God, they're not considered to be persuasive. There are other reasons to believe in God, or you may go beyond reason into faith to believe in God. I don't want to get into whether or not God exists, but there's the pattern here, right? And the pattern is, if you have something, there must be some other thing that created this thing. And that's what shows up in all of Aquinas' arguments, and that's what shows up in all of the different theories of innovation. So as I'm reading through all of this stuff about innovation, I'm thinking of Aquinas and thinking of the different theories for innovation. So, for example, we have the metaphysical theory of innovation. Innovation, we are told, results from prime causes, first movers, or in the words of the business press, drivers. And Peter Drucker is one of the well-known writers on innovation. He tells us about the way unexpected occurrences or incongruities foster innovation, process needs, market changes, demographic changes, and even, surprisingly, new knowledge. All of these things cause innovation to come into being. What we're not told is exactly how these things come into being and why not all changes, not all new knowledge, not all process needs resulting in innovation. I keep wanting to say immigration instead of innovation. I don't know why. The two have nothing to do with each other. It's just one of the mental things. Here's another theory. The character theory of innovation. Innovation springs from the right character. And I know I'm caricaturing this a bit, but that's sometimes how I feel when I'm reading these descriptions of innovation. So being an innovator requires having the right character, which means having certain traits, which are usually the traits of the writer. For example, willing to take chances, or, and this is a direct quote, driven and aggressive yet sensitive. And I'd just love to spend half an hour unpacking that one. What's missing in my mind is, first of all, a process for acquiring these characteristics. How do you become driven and aggressive yet sensitive? Not to mention having an entrepreneurial spirit is another one of these characters. And secondly, being a philosopher, I'm looking for the link between the characteristic and the innovation. Is being driven and aggressive yet sensitive a necessary condition for innovation, a sufficient condition for innovation, or are there other factors? We're going to have a chance to learn more about that. We have Cheryl Lemke speaking on creativity and innovation in K-12, and that's going to be tomorrow afternoon. And she's the one who came up with the phrase, because I checked it out on one of the papers on her website, she's the one who came up with the phrase, driven and aggressive yet sensitive. So I will be eagerly awaiting the explanation of that. And I'm sure all of you will be as well. Here's another theory, and this is the one that directly reminded me of Aquinas, the teleological theory of innovation. And that's the theory that innovation works according to some great design or plan. And so innovations, for innovation to happen, innovators must be goal or outcome driven. And typically, though, some sort of prior art is going to be required in order for this innovation to actually come about. For example, innovation means asking good questions. Innovation means being problem-oriented. Innovation means addressing genuine market needs. Again, there's still this big gap between this and that. How do you get from this design or plan to the innovation when the innovation is, by definition, something that you don't know about yet? We face that where I work, and the less I say about that, the better. But there's the suggestion that you're supposed to know all about your innovation before you have actually come up with your innovation. We have the environmental theory of innovation, and again, we have Lemke talking about this, but the theory is essentially create the right environment and creativity will follow. Richard Florida, I meant to put a reference to him, is a person who uses that. He's the author who talked about the makeup of creative cities, and he talks, and you know, there's an argument for this. He talks about the need for diversity, the need for subcultures and all of that. We hear in the technology field about the creative, innovative environment of Googleplex, MIT Media Lab. We have a speaker coming from MIT Media Lab at this conference, and I'll be interested to hear about the innovations and how the environment fosters the innovations in the Media Lab. The environmental theory of innovation can also be expressed negatively. Descriptions of innovations or environments that stifle creativity, such as monitoring, testing, competition, etc. Again, though, you know, this is me. I want to see the clear link between environment and innovation. Does the environment cause it? Does that mean that anytime I created an environment that was free of monitoring and testing and yet had a foosball table that I would get innovation? Probably not. So there's more of a story to be told here. I'm being a little bit flippant with these theories, and maybe overly so, but I'm trying to draw out the idea here that these are very incomplete. They're theories that hearken almost to a magical theory of innovation. You just do this and magically you have innovation without a clear understanding of what the processes and the mechanisms are that produce innovation. Here's another one which is interesting. Functional theory of innovation. In philosophy, one of the great movements of the 20th century is functionalism. The idea of functionalism is you define things not according to their nature, their makeup, their origin, or their essence. You define things according to their function. That's really interesting because you can even get into defining words according to their function. So you don't define a word according to what it stands for. You define a word according to what it's used for. Fascinating theory. The functional theory of innovation categorizes firms and individuals according to the functional relationship that they have with the product or service that you're trying to innovate. And so, for example, airline firms use this or that aircraft because they expect a certain result from those aircraft. So, and for an airline, it's much more than just move person from A to B. It's like move person from A to B without crashing, or move person from A to B at the lowest possible cost. So the idea here is find the function, find the innovation. Find what people are trying to do with the things that they're trying to use, and you find the innovation. Again, though, it's a little bit circular, right? If they have the function already, then they have the device that they need in order to perform the function. If they don't have the device, they're not performing the function, and therefore you can't find the function in order to come up with the innovation in order to fulfill the function. You see why it's circular. But it's interesting. everybody's favorite, the economic theory of innovation. And that's the simple statement. There is a financial return to be derived from innovation. Therefore, market forces prevail. There is innovation. Obviously, again, there's a big gap between this and that. There's a big gap between the theory behind innovation and the innovation itself. So I find, in my own view, that there's a gap between these accounts of innovation and what is actually innovation. These accounts of innovation, if we go back and refer to them all again, and you can because you have the slideshow right in front of you, they're all trying to tie innovation into phenomena that can be described in so many words and measured with so many numbers, right? Count the number of foosball tables. Count the economic advantage. Identify the function. They're trying to create a direct link between observable, describable phenomenon and innovation. And I think that this is an oversimplification of what is in fact a very complex and non-direct process. So we can use the analysis that I've given you so far as a frame to talk about innovation, and if you follow the link to that article, you'll see a bunch of these sentences, and you map the sentences to the theory, but that's sort of taking us off in a digression. I want to point rather to what von Hippel says about immigration, especially recently, about the concept of democratizing innovation. Because we're moving from this environment or belief or ethos that innovation originates from the marketers and the creators and the inventors and the designers toward the idea that innovation evolves from the end users, that we actually have our finger pointed at the wrong place when we're trying to identify innovation. And it's interesting, Van Hippel says, you know, users that innovate can develop exactly what they want rather than relying on manufacturers to act as their often very imperfect agents. And here's a diagram from one of his papers where we can see, you know, in a four-stage process, and now we actually have a process of innovation, which is a big step forward, where three of the four steps are dominated by the users. So the idea here is that we have this democratization of innovation, but now the dynamics are very different. One of the dynamics that he points to, for example, that we in the field of educational technology have very frequently pointed to, is the whole concept of openness, freely revealing the innovation, and he points out it's a practice that has long predated open source. And it's interesting because you look at why people would do this, and the answer is, well, first of all, why not? And secondly, sharing the innovation from the perspective of an end user is the best way to actually get the innovation to be adopted by anybody. Actually telling people what the innovation is the best way to get it implemented. But now that changes the whole dynamics of the innovation creating infrastructure, if you will. It used to be, and to a large degree still is, the case where we're going to focus our efforts on a few innovation-making enterprises, you know, innovators, inventors, the cream of the crop and all of that. But we find, if we read Van Hippel, that, and it says here, you know, concentrating innovation support resources on a few individuals is hugely inefficient. And I would say similarly, concentrating support resources on a few sectors is also equally inefficient. But why? What's the argument behind that? Because the only arguments we have about innovation are these, you know, the teleological, the economic, right? All of these arguments that lead us to this idea give engineers money, get into innovation, or some such thing. Well, we're going to learn a little bit more about this democratization of innovation from Mark Edwards when he speaks on Monday and also on Tuesday, talking about the use of digital resources and leveraging a distributed leadership team to democratize technology conversion. And I'm going to be looking at that talk, asking, does he understand the same thing by democratizing innovation, democratizing conversion as I do? I look at the idea of democratizing, and I'm thinking of encouraging autonomy, encouraging diversity. It's not, let a thousand lights bloom, or what a terrible analogy, lights don't bloom, but you know what I mean. It's not everybody doing the same thing, but everybody doing different things. It's not everybody marching to the requirements and the dictates of the people on top, but rather in this new model of innovation, it's people who are at the end user level deciding and implementing innovations for themselves. So it'll be interesting to see if this is how Mark Edwards views it as well. So we have this idea, we've shifted from the perspective that we're going to have a few innovators that satisfy the right criteria, they've asked the right questions, or they're the right character, whatever, to the idea that society as a whole, the end users among us all, are the source of innovation. That's a very creaky stage. I hope that doesn't show up on the recording. I feel very nervous because it shifts a bit under me. I thought the rocket boosters were something. So if I suddenly disappear, let me apologize in advance for cutting the talk short. What makes a society innovative? Is it from measurement? Is it from managing all the people in a society? Is it from getting everybody in a society to be market focused? Well, clearly not, right? My argument, and this is the core of the rest of this talk, is that innovation in a society comes from literacy. But now, that's going to need a lot of cashing out. So I went to Wikipedia to find out what literacy is. Fortunately, I was able to understand the definition. Literacy refers to the ability to read for knowledge and write coherently and think critically about the written word. Okay. UNESCO has an interesting definition. Literacy is the ability to identify, understand, interpret, create, communicate, and compute using printed and written materials associated with varying contexts. That is what's known as a LIST definition, where you're trying to define something, you just give a list of things that it might be. Neither of those satisfies. The main problem with them, as the title of this talk might suggest, is that they're too rooted in the traditional text-based definition of literacy. And in the 21st century especially, our understanding of literacy goes far beyond that. So we move to yet another extract from my abstract. In the field of education, we deal every day with learning and discovery that goes beyond what we can describe. And so I look at this and I apply it to literacy and I say, what is literacy? It isn't just language. It isn't even just numbers. It isn't just literacy and numeracy. It's beyond that, and in a one phrase slogan type of account, literacy is the capacity to recognize what is relevant, useful, true, etc. So this is a bit of a different approach to literacy. It's a bit of a different approach to knowledge. But I think by the end of the talk, you'll get what I mean. You may agree with me or disagree with me, your choice, obviously, but I think you'll see this from a different perspective, which is the objective here. So even if we look at literacy traditionally, we can see ourselves moving off the traditional definition when we look at things like functional literacy. UNESCO, in the same document, talks about literacy as freedom. We get the concept of a turning point here, allying the concept of literacy to social and economic development. And it's this ties, you have literacy to social and economic development to innovation. And now you've got some links being created here. Or we have Paulo Freire talking about the political dimension of literacy, conscientization, the understanding of the world. I don't want to talk about, well, I don't want to get into Freire, but the political and empowerment dimensions of literacy. In this respect, I'll be interested, and there was a, I'm not sure if it was a typo in the program or an inventive way of making the same point. We have Keith Kruger. The title actually says Reimaging Learning, which I thought was a great way of saying it. I think he may have meant reimagining learning. And in the abstract it says, society has moved to a more participatory culture, which I've just mentioned, where information and expertise is increasingly less hierarchical and society is more participatory. It's an idea of learning as conversation. It's this whole Web 2.0 social networks. We exchange ideas. But of course, if it's reimaging learning, then we're speaking in more than just words. We're speaking in, well, images, lolcats, anything and everything. So I'll be interested to see whether that was a typo or it was a typo. Oh, I'm so disappointed. I think you should go with the title, Reimaging Learning, own it, and rewrite the talk by tomorrow. That's my challenge to you. okay. Well, the idea of going beyond text in literacy isn't new. So for those of you who are sort of mentally slapping me and saying, we've done this before. There's the whole concept of multiple literacies, right? Visual literacy, so understanding all the different body language, pictures, maps, video. It's interesting. You don't think about that until it's not there. I was in India and they have these little the little cabs called tuk-tuks, and which I love, but I discovered that you can't show them a map. Well, maybe you can show some of them maps, but none of the ones that I rode did a map work. The representation of the city and their understanding of the city were two separate things. So I had to say turn left, turn right, turn left. That was how they represented the city to themselves. Howard Gardner, of course, proposes 8 different intelligences for a broad range of human potential in children and adults, and here they are, verbal, logical, visual, spatial, etc. But Gardner's not the only one to develop alternative literacies. Henry Jenkins, who's looked at a lot of the 21st century skills, 21st century literacies, the whole idea of storytelling online and things like that, has talked about things like play, performance, simulation, appropriation, multitasking, etc., etc. There's a number of others. And there is this sense, isn't there, where with all of these new technologies and all of these new pedagogies, there are more and more new literacies. I feel like I'm ignoring that side of the room. I'm not really. I'm just sort of, I hope you don't feel ignored over there. And so we have financial literacy, we have computer literacy, we have media literacy. We had one of the suggestions in Google Plus this afternoon was systems literacy, and on and on and on it goes. Many of these literacies are on display in educational innovations like the flipped classroom, where the content is distributed and or consumed overnight in the form of videos, readings, etc., and the classroom time is taken up in collaborative and other directly educational focused activities. And Patrick Bonnet and Ken Hackstall will be talking about that, flipping your instruction. And it'll be interesting to see if there's a connection between these new literacies that are required in the 21st century learning environment and the pedagogical practices that take place in the flipped classroom. I don't plug everyone, but I plug many. The skills, I want to take a bit of a turn here. Because, you know, I've now got more literacies than I have fingers, and I have a lot of fingers. I want to say that the skills and the literacies described by Jenkins and others, performance simulations, etc., are actually languages. They're all different languages and should be understood through a framework that we can borrow from languages. I don't want to say it's a linguistic framework because that would be to misrepresent it. So each one of these literacies is a type of language. And you can say it's not really a big jump, right? It's not a big jump from saying that kinesthetic literacy is a literacy to kinesthesiology is a language. There's a natural evolution here. It's a bit harder when we start talking about simulation as a language, but it's not impossible to imagine that, right? And if you think about it, a lot of what's happening in these new media, in Web 2.0, in social media, in videos online, Khan Academy, all of that, is the use of new technologies to employ new languages to express concepts in different ways. And when you do that, you're able to express more concepts and get beyond what we could simply express in the written word. That's why video is so powerful, because you can do things with video that you can't do with text. Just ask Alfred Hitchcock. I was camping recently, we watched Hitchcock movies. Never again. Never again. Yeah, there's even an innovation literacy, which means, according to my theory, there's a language of innovation, or that innovation itself is a language. And if you think about that, you go back to all the discussion and the dialogue and the things that come out of think tanks and all of that, they are using innovation and the discussion around innovation to say stuff. And it's very interesting to try to read what they're saying with their dialogue about innovation. One of the things that I think they're saying, and I think I proved it in the slide earlier, one of the things they're saying, engineering is important, humanities are not. That's a pretty simplistic representation of what they're saying. I think if we analyze the discussion and the dialogue around innovation more deeply, we find interesting messages. Okay, but how do we understand this? Yeah, there's Andrew Flowerdew expressed a concern that many people express. We have all of these literacies. Each and every one of these is a literacy silo. And so now we've got, you know, math and science and chemistry, science including chemistry, and all of the rest of them to teach. And now we have to teach visual literacy, computer literacy, media literacy. It gets ridiculous, doesn't it? And we end up with this horrible mishmash. It's almost a tower of Babel of literacies. I'll have to remember that. So the way to understand this is to understand that all of these literacies are forms of recognition. They're forms of knowledge by recognition. And if we can get at what knowledge by recognition is, we can get at these literacies. Well, what is knowledge by recognition? This is the problem with philosophy, right? You get here, you think, all right, it's knowledge by recognition. Okay, what's knowledge by recognition? Move one step back. Oh, well, it's like recognizing a cat. Okay, what's recognizing a cat? Move one step back, and all the way down to turtles. So, but okay, let's stay with knowledge by recognition. And let's say knowledge by recognition can be as simple as recognizing a cat, which everyone can do, right? Or we saw deer outside today. We all recognized, I hope, that they were deer and not cats. Or it can be recognition is applied to very complex systems, like weather patterns, ecosystems, which we're also surrounded by, and a really wonderful one, human society, and dare I say, innovation. Okay, so how do we get at that? The way I get at that, and I emphasize it's the way I get at that. You don't have to get at it this way, but it works for me. It's a frame. There's a frame I call critical literacies. And what the critical literacies are the elements that are in common across all of the literacies. And they give us a mechanism for understanding and talking about what it means to be visually literate, musically literate, computer literate, and the rest of it. And to anticipate, it gives us a frame and a dialogue, or a frame and a vocabulary to talk about what we're trying to do when we're innovating with new technologies for learning, when we're innovating with new new technologies for learning. I got off immigrate, now I'm on technologies. So the human mind is a very strange and not always understandable thing. So here are the critical literacies, and they look a lot like elements from language. That's deliberate, so that you get what they are right away. But they're also kind of a little bit outside of the elements of language, so you see that it's not just a linguistic kind of thing. This is the way I divide them. You can slice them and dice them in any way that is handy for you. Again, I'm not saying the world is divided into six essential categories or anything like that. That would be silly. But they're useful. And so here's how they should be understood. The traditional literacies are the vertical silos. And then the critical literacies that I'm describing here are horizontal layers to these literacies that cut across all of these silos. So you take syntax, for example, and we can understand pretty easily that there's a syntax to verbal language. There's also a syntax to visual language. There's a grammar of body language. Kathy Mateos, M-A-T-T-E-O-S, I think. Catherine? No. I'd have to look that up. I'll look it up and put it on my slide page. I've referred to her a lot before. Has a whole grammar of visual imagery, visual communication. There's a grammar of bodily communication. There's a syntax of performance. There's a syntax of computers. Everybody has learned this syntax. You want to turn something off, it's up there. Unless it's Mac, it's up there. That's the big problem with Mac and PC is they use different syntaxes. Just as an aside, I upgraded right before this trip, because I like to live dangerously. I upgraded OS X on my MacBook. And all of a sudden, none of my scroll bars worked. And I discovered that normally when I scroll, pull a little scroll bar down, the little thing goes down. Tried that on a Mac, didn't work. I realized that what they had done is adopt what Mac calls, quote unquote, natural scrolling, which means if I want the little thing on the side to go down, I have to push up. So there I am pushing up on my scroll bar to make my screen go down. I finally figured out how to make it go back. But you can see there's a grammar, a syntax of scroll bars. And you mess with that syntax, you confuse people. And many of you, maybe not most of you, are involved in computer programming, are involved in teaching how to use, people how to use software, I have no doubt that you depend on this syntactical awareness of how computer programs function. You can sit down, if you're experienced, and work with a new video editing program, even if you've never used a video editing program before, but you've got the basic syntax, and you know how to explore your way through the program to make it do the sort of things that you want to do. Computer syntax. Or, if you want to go a level deeper, computer languages have a syntax. Or if you want to go even deeper, binary arithmetic has a syntax. It's syntax all the way down. So, there we have syntax. For example, rules and grammar. What is it to know syntax? Because, you know, again, like I can just magically refer to syntax and say, understand syntax and innovation will happen. Well, no, it's not. That's, you can't just go from understand syntax to innovation. We need to know what it is to know syntax. We need to have some kind of comprehension of what syntax literacy is. So, okay, let's get beyond the idea that syntax is rules of language and grammar. Everything has a syntax, as I suggested. We have the forms, Platonic forms. The elements of Euclidean geometry constitute the syntax. Rules, grammars, logical syntax is also a syntax. The rules of punctuation are syntax. But you can also describe syntax in terms of operation. There's a whole school of philosophy called operationalism. And their theory is every rule of language in mathematics does not describe the manipulation of words and numbers. It describes operations that we undertake. So 2 plus 2 equals 4 isn't some statement about the quantity 2 and the quantity 2 being the quantity 4. It's the actual operation of moving 2 pebbles and 2 pebbles to get a pile of 4 pebbles. I'm caricaturing it a bit, but not a lot. That's operationalism. You read people like Philip Kitcher, for example, and they describe how mathematics, through an operational understanding, can be reduced to experience and practice. Patterns are types of syntax. In fact, in my mind, all syntax, in a sense, is a type of pattern. Regularities, substitutivity. If you have a chance, look up on Google something called eggcorns. There's a whole website out there, it's called the Eggcorn Database. You might think, well, eggcorns? Well, it's because somebody referred to an acorn as an eggcorn. And, you know, an eggcorn is a word that you get wrong, but it kind of fits. Acorn, eggcorn. It's another classic one. He's taking the wrong tact. Right, and of course the expression, it comes from sailing, is he's taking the wrong tack, because tacking is a maneuver in sailing. But people substitute tact for tack, and okay, yeah, it's a mistake, but it kind of makes sense, right? New tack, anyhow, there's a whole database of these eggcorns. These eggcorns, there's the dialogue around eggcorn, the pattern around eggcorn is a type of syntax. It's not logical, grammatical syntax, but if you understand that it is a syntax, you can understand eggcorns. And you can also, if you understand that there is a syntax, you can understand things like lolcats. I have a whole talk speaking in lolcats, looking at those stupid little pictures of cats with sayings like "I can has cheeseburger." And there's a syntax behind them, and understanding the syntax tells us what these people are trying to do with these lolcats. It's a way of getting at what's happening in these Web 2.0 phenomena. Similarities. Similarities are a type of syntax. Saying that something is similar to something else is a way of relating these two things. There's a whole range of audio syntax. There's one, I just can't get past it. I actually linked to it here, and you can follow it. Well, maybe this will work. I'm going to test this. And you click on it, and oh, here we go. What's going to happen? Nothing. Don't say nothing. Oh, right. Flash has crashed. Dang. Never mind. We're not going to be able to see it. No. Is it taking down everything? Okay. Anyhow. And now PowerPoint is crashed. Oh, goody. don't send. So, isn't that fun? You ever do a keynote and have PowerPoint crash right in the middle of it? Anyhow, what I was trying to link to, and instead crashing everything on the system, there's a little audio snippet. It's like a second. And it's a woman's voice that goes, oh. Once you hear it, you can't stop hearing it. It's in like a dozen commercials, right? The pizza comes in, you hear a woman's voice, oh. It's this little piece of punctuation. It's obviously it's not text-based punctuation. It's exhalation-based punctuation. I'm just looking to see where I was now. Frame to talk about innovation. I'm way down here. All right. Here we go. I'm almost there. Okay, this is close enough. And let's get us back up. If you're listening, if you're in the Hangout and speaking, I can't hear you. I'm sorry. And I can't see the chat. I'm sorry. I've concluded that trying to manage a Hangout and a PowerPoint presentation and various flash sounds on one computer with a brand new operating system while giving a talk, maybe not a wise move. But, you know, it was worth trying. So, oh yeah, it's on the next slide. Okay, there's another one called the Wilhelm or Wilhelm scream. I know you've heard it. It's kind of like, ah! And, the big cannon sends a fireball into the fort. And so on, you know. The World War I battle. Same scream, same guy. In about 14, 15 different movies, in vampire movies, zombie movies. Again, it's punctuation, right? It's not because the director wanted you to think there's actually a guy screaming, right? It's a form of punctuation saying, you should have this reaction here. Some guy died or whatever. You know, syntax is interesting. Syntax travels. It wanders. There's a whole domain of learning patterns, design patterns, learning design. And we have here Kathy Howery talking about universal design for learning. And I read that. Now, admittedly, again, I've only read the abstract. I cannot review a presentation that takes place in the future. But I read that, and I'm thinking it's a syntax, right? It's a way of creating a logical structure of learning. And when I look at something like that, I'm going to be asking questions in my mind along the lines of, is it a good syntax? Is it universal? Is it expressible? Is it complete? Is it decidable? The sorts of questions a logician would ask about a syntax, because that's how you evaluate a syntax. Here's another example of syntax. This is drawing from Jenkins again. Jenkins talking about the skill of performance. Well, there are multiple, you extend your understanding of what a syntax is, there are multiple ways of talking about the syntax of performance. And, you know, so we've got the Stanislavski's method, or the method. You have ritual performance, rituals themselves. You have comparing tales. I don't know anything about the syntax of performance. But just looking around on the internet, I was able to find a number of abstract representations of performance, a number of syntaxes of performance. So again, If we want to understand performance, if there's such a thing as a performance literacy, then there's a performance syntax that is a part of that. And understanding performance is understanding that syntax, at least partially, right? So when people are doing things like performances, Jenkins talks about people in, for example, online games, taking on new identities and acting as though they're this or that. And I had experience with that firsthand in online games myself, and I'm sure many of you have. There's there are different ways of understanding that. There are different ways of understanding the sort of performance that might be expected in a game environment. And even more interestingly, from the perspective of designing game environments, there are different ways of understanding how a game can be used to induce different types of performance. So what is, you might ask the designer, the syntax of the performance you want this game to induce? Do you want people to assume the method and the, you know, the methodology and the characteristics of the character? Do you want them to perform a certain series of steps? You know, a lot of times bad games, bad game design isn't clear about that, and it reduces the performance in the game to do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. At which point the smarter people out there write macros and they just hit a button and they go collect their swords or whatever. I know, I did it. But we're still not there yet. How do we talk about knowing, understanding, learning these syntaxes? There must be, mustn't there, level, because you don't just, you know, go from not knowing a syntax to knowing a syntax. That doesn't work, right? So there must be levels of understanding these syntaxes. You see the trouble with this, right? This is why at the beginning of this talk, I'm really being a bit flippant about, you know, these definitions of innovation, because you start pushing it and you go, you know, you unpeel another layer. It's not a simple thing. It's not simply the right character, the right environment. That just whitewashes a vast swath of interesting phenomena that we as educators need to get our minds around in order to understand innovation at all. So, okay, we have literacy. We have the concept of literacy levels. And I went out and found a few things about literacy levels online. Many of you will be able to find many more things. There's one here from Windsor Public Library, basic word recognition all the way up to technical reading. Here's another one I found talking about different types of literacy, logographics, reading and writing that relies on context, which is, again, there's a whole talk about that, right? Alphabetic, sound letter correspondences, orthographic, highly sophisticated and complex understanding of a written language, whatever that means. We can think of varying conceptions of knowing, right? If we're talking about knowing syntax, if we're talking about being literate in syntax, we're talking about various kinds of knowing about syntax. So what are the kinds of knowing? We're finally beginning to get to something here. And it's a good thing because we're up to, well, never mind. So there's knowledge as remembering. There's knowledge as understanding. So that's, those seem like kind of low-level understandings of knowledge. Now we get the kind of knowledge that people are talking about in the innovation domain. Knowledge is using, knowledge is applying. Bloom's and Bloom's taxonomy, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and the revised version of Bloom's taxonomy, will take us a lot further than that. And now we're going to have six levels of knowledge. Of course, this is knowledge generally, not knowledge. Oh, thank you. That was well done. Six creative uses of an iPad there, giving me an impossibly short timeline. six levels of knowledge, but knowledge generally as opposed to knowledge of syntax or knowledge of language. But still, a useful frame to wrap our minds around. So remembering, understanding, etc., all the way up to creating. So creating is the highest of these types of knowledge. We're going to have Karen Brennan talking about creativity. And it'll be interesting to see the connection between creativity and literacy. She's talking about moving from the idea of people as consumers of interactive media to people as creators of interactive media. But what does that mean? Is it just simply going out there and making stuff? Well, probably not, right? So in talking about being creators of interactive media, we're already going to be talking about, among other things, what the syntax of that is, what the structures of creating interactive media are, what sort of frames that we'll use, what sort of regularities, patterns, or principles that we'll encounter along the way. Well, to understand literacy and syntactic literacy, I've tried to come up with a very simplified taxonomy. Again, the world is not sliced and diced in this way. I'm just getting at a broad range of ideas here rather than saying the world progresses in this way and it goes through these levels. I'm not Piaget. I don't do that. But we can kind of get at what we mean by knowledge of syntax if we look at these different levels of syntactic literacy. Simple remembering of the rules. You will do what you're told. Recognizing an instance of a rule. So, first of all, remembering that a tiger is something that's black and white. Secondly, recognizing something that's black and white as a tiger. It's a step up, right? Third, discovering that tigers are things that are orange and black. Sorry, tigers aren't black and white. I was talking about Siberian tigers, that's it. Fourth level, choosing between different syntaxes, distinguishing tigers as things that are orange and black versus things that have claws and fangs, which is a relevantly more important criterion. And then finally, creating in an intuitive way, I'm sort of channeling Dreyfus here, in an intuitive way, rules, regulations of your own. And the impossibly short timeline tells me I can't linger on that point. Okay, so what kind of knowledge of syntax is this? Well, again, it's knowledge as recognition. Well, what do I mean by that? Here's an intuitive way of thinking of it. Knowing something is like knowing where Waldo is. There's a Where's Waldo? And Waldo, as you all know, has glasses, a striped shirt, and a little toque, right? And I'm going to point. There he is. Right? Now you see him, you can't not know where he is anymore. Right? You cannot look at that and wonder where Waldo is. Because I've just shown, and now you've seen it. Now you recognize where Waldo is. Now you know where Waldo is. That's what knowledge is, right? Knowledge is not being able to not see the thing you see. Well, how does that work? Knowledge is created by neural connections. When you establish a certain neural connection, you've acquired a certain bit of knowledge, whatever that is. The traditional way of representing knowledge as a sentence, Paris is the capital of France, or even as something semantical, Paris is the capital of France, is true, is good, is valuable, is where it ought to be, is actually a series of connections in a complex network. Knowing that Paris is the capital of France is to have that set of connections. So how do you know that Paris is the capital of France? You can't not know it. It's a property of you. When somebody says to you, Paris is the capital of France, you know, oh yeah, right, yeah. Or if somebody asks you, what is the capital of France? The idea or the answer occurs to you, Paris, and a whole bunch of other things too. You might be thinking, if you're a comedian, 49 cents. But that's a bad joke. It's an old joke. So knowing that Paris is the capital of France is kind of like what it feels like to know that Paris is the capital of France. You see the distinction here? So knowing a syntax is having that feeling for that syntax. Again, this is the Dreyfus expert level kind of knowledge, right? The syntax is internalized in you. It is actually part of your physical constitution. So learning a discipline, learning a literacy, is a total state. It's not here you acquire this rule, here you acquire this rule, here you acquire this rule. A syntax is acquired not as a whole, but when it's instantiated inside you, it's instantiated as a whole. It's not instantiated as eight separate rules, eight separate principles. And we can understand this, we can evaluate this, we can see this by our performance, among other things, but I'll pick the quick and easy way because I have negative time left, by our performance in these social networks. When we behave in a social network, we are instantiating our knowledge of the syntax of the operations of that social network. When we create a lolcat, we demonstrate in that act whether or not we understand the syntax of lolcats. And if you go to I Can Has Cheeseburger, eventually over time, you look at several thousand of them, as I have, and you say, that person didn't get it. This person got it. That person didn't get it. That's a moose. All right, so the others, semantics, traditionally theories of truth. But what are the more wide understandings of semantics? Theories of truth, meaning, purpose, goal. They're, in a sense, the way we attach a reference to our sentences, but more than just that. Curriculum is a semantics. Curriculum, and especially the idea of a better curriculum, a worse curriculum, the elements of curriculum that tie to attitudes, to perspectives, to ways of viewing the world, are all semantical elements of the content that we are attempting to teach. I'm sorry. Elliot Soloway and Kathy Norris. I don't want to skip you, but I don't have any time. the semantics of pedagogy, and I found this interesting. The transformation of the classroom from I teach, a teacher-centric, didactic, direct instruction, 19th century, boring, and ineffective pedagogy, to we learn, a student-centric, project-based, inquiry-oriented 21st century pedagogy. That is a sentence, or more accurately, a phrase loaded with semantics, isn't it? There are layers and layers of meaning to it. It's not simply, do we evaluate, is this sentence true, is this sentence false? We analyze that sentence for objectives, evaluations, purposes, goals, etc. Brief aside. If we're in a democracy, as we want to be, reading von Hippel, then we have different goals, different objectives, different purposes. Therefore, there's no single semantics. So you can't talk about simply transforming from state A to state B, but rather state A to B, C, D, E, F, and to however many learners as there are. I'll probably have to explain that in a later post. There are many meanings of semantics, many ways of understanding what words stand for, what they represent. Sense and reference are the obvious ones, what a word stands for, what it represents. But, there are different ways of interpreting a syntax. There's a theory of probability coined by Frank Ramsey that says the probability P that something is true is equivalent to how much you would bet on it being true. It's a real theory. And you talk to economists, they use that theory all the time. So, I mean, right, my first reaction on reading Ramsey was to laugh, and then I realized our entire economic system is based on it. Forms of association, decisions, decision theory, all of these are elements of semantics. All of these are contained in our technologies, and when we're creating and using these technologies, we want to ask, not simply, is the sentence we are saying true, but also, are we valuing the truth of that sentence? Are we placing people into a certain frame for interpreting reality in a certain way? For example, the toss of a coin, the wager of a bet, etc. Pragmatics is the third major element. Pragmatics, the use, actions, or impact. And now we're getting more to the heart of innovation. And indeed, an innovation agenda is an agenda which prioritizes pragmatics over, say, semantics. Speech acts. You know, John Searle and J.L. Austin talk a lot about using speech to do things. And anyone who has said, I do, has committed a speech act. Interrogation. Heidegger has a whole philosophy based around the concept of interrogation. To ask a question is not to make a statement, except when you're trying to sneak something in there. And there's a whole linguistic presupposition of interrogation that happens. Meaning, in Wittgenstein's philosophy, is equivalent to the use of a word. What a word means is the same as the way we use it. That's a bit hard to get your head around. Cognition is the fourth major element of literacy. Cognition, in my mind, breaks down to four major elements. I can only quickly summarize. Description, and there are many ways of describing, from allegory to metaphor to Bertrand Russell's definite description and the rest. Definition, and we could write a book about definition. Argument and explanation. And being able to argue and being able to explain are, of course, essential elements of any sort of literacy. Using video to describe is one thing. Using video to argue, as Michael Moore will tell you, is something else entirely. And the two are different skills. We do have a talk on critical thinking skills. Howie de Blasio will be talking about cultivating creativity in critical thinking skills. And my interpretation of that is, yes, there's a link between creativity and critical thinking. But it's a narrow link, right? There are these other five literacies, and I'm going to be wondering about that. Context is the fifth of these. Context is the environment or set of beliefs or frame or vocabulary in which an assertion takes place. Understanding context is as important as understanding meaning. Sometimes it's essential to understanding meaning. Finally, change. Understanding change, understanding the different theories of change, the different ways change are represented in language, the different ways we use different languages to represent change also constitute a part of literacy. Again, if you're designing an educational application, are you presupposing a theory of change? People naturally assume, so we're told, a linear theory of change. We know that that's a bad theory. We have enough stock market crashes to prove it. So what do we say? Well, then we have a wave theory of change. It's all in waves, right? But we know that that's a bad theory, as the impact of an asteroid into Jupiter demonstrates. You know, sometimes these waves end. What kind of change are you building into your representations? It's the sort of thing that you need to be asking, but also, too, it's the sort of thing that you need to be thinking